Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we are listening to Sins of Our Fathers, a novel by Sean Lawrence Otto, published in 2014 by Milkweed Editions. The audiobook version is broadcast with permission from Blackstone Audio.
Why are you doing this? Because you got a boy out there who needs you. Not that you noticed. Not that his dad noticed either. He's so fired up about getting that bank going. Why don't you get cleaned up? You look like J.W. stared at the wall and listened to her jabbing the bacon around. I'm serious. Get your ass out of bed. He sighed and turned over. After a moment, he swung his dead legs slowly down to the floor. He sat still for a moment, a wave of dizziness, then got up and stumbled into the bathroom, clearing his dry throat. Don't just take a pee and brush your teeth, he heard her say outside the cardboard-thin door. I expect a man to be showered and shaved and nicely dressed when I cook him breakfast. J.W. flushed the toilet and made it so. When he stepped back into the kitchen, he saw she had found a tablecloth that he didn't even know he had, a bright yellow tourist map of Minnesota, with lumberjacks in the northeast, the Mississippi headwaters in the northwest, and a jumping trout in the center near Brainerd. Laid out on it were plates of purple-brown Mazan pancakes, bacon, eggs over easy, coffee, Many Lakes Ojibwe maple syrup, and orange juice. A plastic trash can by the door served as a basket for the unused foodstuffs and cooking utensils she had brought. She seemed happy. Move! Sit! He slipped onto the bench by the door. The morning was warmer than the last few had been, which he took as a good omen. There were deep half moons under his eyes that the shower hadn't cured, and his hands were shaky from low blood sugar. A fecund, cool breeze wafted in through the windows and over the tablecloth, smelling of earth, oak bark, and leaves. Mona's shaggy hair hung around her face in the cool morning light. He watched the shifting seas of her eyes as she chewed her bacon, holding a half piece between her fingers. Indians could have light eyes and even blonde hair, he knew, but her eyes were striking. They had fine dark rims around the irises that gave her a slightly wild quality. J.W. set down his fork and swallowed. Thank you. So what are you so depressed about? She picked up her mug of coffee and held it between her hands, warming them the same way Carol did. J.W. laughed painfully and poked at his pancakes with his fork. Well, I lost my son, my job, my reputation, my house, and all my money, and now I've lost what was left of my family. I heard you had a gambling problem, but you're not gambling. You're lying in bed. J.W. sighed. I guess I just decided to feel bad, and that's the safest place to do it. Decided to feel bad. Kind of weird. Instead of going and gambling it away, which is what I've been doing. I was sitting there in the casino parking lot, and I thought, I don't want to go back into the avalanche. I can just sit here and feel this feeling, you know, for 1 minute. That's doable. Then reevaluate. And the minutes have sort of strung together. I'm hoping it'll run out, but I would feel guilty if it did. He shrugged. It sounded stupid. Actually, that's sort of profound, she said. Then nodded as if that confirmed something and looked out at the trees. Although, judging from the condition I found you in, I don't know if it's the best long-term strategy. He snorted and nodded, and they went back to their breakfast. I have a question for you, he said finally, and finished swallowing. How did Jacob's mom die? She looked back down at her food. He sensed a sudden momentousness, as if she didn't want to get into it. She took up her knife and cut off another piece of pancake. She OD'd. Her mouth drew into a thin line. She crammed the pancake in and began chewing. J.W. nodded slowly. Did she always do drugs? No. That was my problem. She stared at him defiantly as she stuffed another piece in her mouth. The feathers in her hair hung by her cheek. He could tell that she was ready for a fight, but he had never felt less judgmental. He nodded. She shook her head and began to pick at her food with the tip of her fork. She was on the straight and narrow. Why did she start?
Look, I don't know what he's told you, but it wasn't my fault, okay?
I didn't mean that. I don't know anything about it. His voice was gentle. He reached for a way to make her understand. Some gift of intimacy. I used to be real close to my son. I mean, we were... He shook his head and held up two fingers. Like that. But as he got older, he kind of got away from me. I don't know how. I think I was just too busy. And he just fell in with some rough kids. But maybe it wasn't even that. Maybe it was just bad luck. He tried to miss a deer on the highway just east of town, and he crashed. Gone. Just like that. After the funeral, I thought I was fine. You know, the strong husband, man of the family, wife and daughter grieving uncontrollably, but I was okay. And then I just started spending more time at the casino. I don't even know how it happened. I guess it was just a little shot of hope. Or sometimes I think maybe I was just trying to fight back against chance, against the bad luck that killed him and ruined my life. And you know what? I have no f***ing idea, and it doesn't matter. Things don't always have to make sense. She nodded slightly, then looked down at her plate. Her boss at the bank, he used to run the branch up here. He hired her out of high school to come work in Minneapolis. J.W. thought he vaguely remembered her, but he couldn't be sure. He was really nice to her, told her how smart she was. He kept promoting her, and we all thought, God, she's really made it. But then one day she calls me and says she just talked to her boss on her cell. He was back up here, and he called her down in Minneapolis and said that there was a discrepancy in the books, that somebody had reported her. He said he was going to call the FBI. She was totally freaking out. I mean, this girl was valedictorian, okay? Johnny was her dream. Building this bank was her dream. There's no way she would put all that in jeopardy by stealing. Mona's righteous anger was rising. J.W. frowned and shook his head in agreement. She drove all the way up here to show him proof, but she was nervous. Mona swallowed and looked out at the leaves, her chin on the butt of her hand and her wild eyes shining. She got careless. Girl just got careless. What do you mean? J.W. asked. He felt certain he was on the cusp of something. She sighed deeply. Rather than look at him, she told the story to the trees. Her boss was in a room at the casino hotel. He didn't want proof. At first she thought she didn't have any choice. I mean, what woman would put herself in that situation, right? She must have deserved it somehow. But then she told him no. She said no, and he raped her. J.W. closed his eyes. I... He shook his head, fumbling for a new hold on things. Why didn't she press charges? Mona looked back at him. J.W. She spoke to him in the tone of a disappointed mother. Even in her anguish, she was obviously disgusted by the question. Tribes can't prosecute white people. Don't you know that? And state laws don't apply the same way on reservations. And then he had whatever evidence. Jorgensen's like you. He works the loopholes. He looked at her, instantly ashamed. Like me? Mona continued, disregarding his objection. She bought a morning after pill and she came here. She wanted to get high and forget all about it before she went home to her man and her baby, and I was... She froze, and her voice broke. Stupid enough to let her. She wept at the trees for a moment, then looked directly back at J.W.
Johnny's never forgiven me, and I guess I haven't either.
He sat, frozen, and listened to her quiet sobbing. The sun in the birch's yellow leaves spoke of fall, of vulnerability, and decomposition. Chapter 30. When the doorbell rang, Jacob was thinking about the fire's aftermath and stabbing his knee with a compass. It was something he had begun doing lately, without knowing why. He sat on the toilet and pushed the sharp end of the compass into the soft skin on the side of his kneecap until it bled. The pain somehow brought focus and some fleeting measure of absolution from his gnawing fear and guilt. He was at loose ends, his mind shuffling and disjointed. He and Cheese Whiz had split from Hey-Ho and Jeremy at the bank and run in a different direction. They heard the gunshot and kept running, afraid that one of the other two had been shot by Grossman. They hid in the trees, afraid to move or make a sound. When the fire was put out, they circled back, only to find that the car was gone. They waited for half an hour, wondering if Hey-Ho or Jeremy would come back for them, and then they decided to walk onto the reservation so no one would know they had been in town. They stayed in the ditches along the highway and cut through the fields to the reservation road, and then Cheese Whiz called his uncle Smokestack, who picked them up from the old sweat lodge site where they had been drinking beer earlier in the day. Eagle was angry when he learned that Jacob had left in spite of the fact that he was grounded, but then Jacob told him how they had been at Jeremy's grandmother's, eating fry bread and listening to her stories, and then how Cheese Whiz had shown him how to do a sweat, how they build the lodge out of birch branches and deer hides, but how his uncle Smokestack just uses tarps. Why worry about deer hides? But the fire tender would still use a deer antler to carry the hot grandfathers one by one from the fire into the lodge, and then how they would throw sweet grass and water on the hot stones, swatting themselves with fresh branches as they asked the spirits in. Jacob saw his father's face soften. He rushed through the story, making the account so detailed and enthusiastic that his dad finally raised a hand to cut him off. Instead of punishing Jacob, he just sent him to his room with a warning not to do it again. It wasn't until the next morning that Cheese Whiz called to tell Jacob that it was Grossman who had been shot. Hey-Ho and Jeremy had gone to visit relatives in Montana. They agreed to say that Cheese Whiz had spent the evening teaching Jacob about sweats as a way to welcome him into the band. In the days since, Jacob had lived in terror of someone discovering his role in the bank episode. In hindsight, he realized that he had put everything, their lives here, his father's mission, their relationship, at risk in one stupid moment, and now he was trapped in its looming shadow. When the doorbell rang, his heart leaped. His dad wasn't home, and the police had been everywhere asking questions. He wiped the blood from his knee with a wad of toilet paper, then tiptoed silently to the front door and peeked through the peephole. It was J.W. Jacob stood deliberating for a long moment, then pulled the door open, relieved and angry at the same time. "Jacob," said J.W. His eyes were rimmed with red as if he had been crying. "I just learned what happened to your mom. I don't know what to say." Jacob felt an impulse to slam the door in his face, but another part of him wanted to apologize. "Where have you even been?" he said. J.W. sensed his anger. "I just took a few days off," he said. "I'm sorry. I'm back now. And I'm supposed to be happy." "I thought maybe we could work on the horse." "Are you kidding me?" How could he tell J.W. that everything had changed, that he had tried to burn the town bank down, that he was living in terror, that he hated J.W. for abandoning him? He looked away at the unfinished living room. "Okay," replied J.W. "Wait." Jacob didn't know what to say. J.W. nodded and turned away. Panic reared up in Jacob. "Wait!" J.W. paused. "I'm sorry," Jacob said, floundering in confusion. "Hey," said J.W., "it all just—" and Jacob knew he understood. Jacob rode Pride bareback. He was still angry, but it felt good to be focused on something outside of himself. Maybe he could just forget about what had happened, red boy, blue boy, meld with the horse. He felt in charge around J.W. as if he could see things that he forgot about otherwise. Who he was. How he was. What mattered. The feeling slowly started to counter crazy, out-of-control fear and guilt he'd been swimming in since the shooting. He knew Ernie would tell his dad that he was working with J.W. again, and he knew his dad would be angry, but he didn't care. He needed this, like water. This was the one thing he was doing that wasn't wrecking things, and his dad would just have to deal with it. He walked the horse around J.W., who stood in the center of the paddock. "Okay," said J.W., his hands in his jean pockets. "Let's bring him up to a trot. What you got?" Jacob shifted his balance forward and gave a slight squeeze with his knees, prompting Pride to step up into a trot. "Good job. Nice transition," J.W. called after him. "Keep him in the same circle now. Don't let him wind out." Jacob smiled in spite of himself. J.W. knew what he had just accomplished, even if it was lost on everyone else. The intricate details, the subtle communication, the shifts of balance that took hours of practice and concentration and only made things look invisible and natural to everyone else. He went around again for another dose of praise, focused intently on the circle, the perfect circle at a fast trot with loose reins. He shifted his weight to face slightly into the circle he wanted Pride to create, their minds becoming one. "That's right," cheered J.W. Jacob kept Pride turning at a steady trot, raising dust that lifted into a yellow cloud, around and around and around. "Good," J.W. bellowed at him through the dust. "Bareback is all about balance and connection. As your discipline improves, so does his." The rhythmic motion and the fur and the sweat and the reins in his hands, the thumping hoofbeats, and J.W.'s shouted encouragement all grounded Jacob and brought him back from the cloud of anxiety he'd been caught up in. He vowed he would never go back to his bad ways. He felt Pride's spine becoming one with his tailbone, the two of them fusing into one animal, one nervous system, one brain, one ocean of emotions. "This happens because he tests you, and again he finds he can trust you," J.W. bellowed through the dust. "Discipline, consistency, trust." Red boy, blue boy, red boy, blue boy. It went through his mind like a drumbeat. One animal, one animal, one animal, one. "With these three things, your horse becomes more than just an animal. He moves beyond just doing the job in spite of his emotions. He learns to discipline the emotions themselves." Jacob's thighs were wet with Pride's sweat. He leaned forward imperceptibly, and Pride stepped into a perfect rolling canter. The tribal council met informally in the chair's second-floor office in the new community center. The three men and two women who could make it sat around a large oak table, surrounded by a 4-foot-high wainscoting of quarter-sawn oak. The tribal chair's imposing carved oak desk sat diagonally in a far corner, flanked by the flags of the United States, the state of Minnesota, the POW/MIA, and the Many Lakes Band of Ojibwe. They were meeting as an ad hoc property committee on a special question relating to a new tribal bank. Johnny Eagle sat by himself on one wide side of the table, and they sat on the other, the windows to their backs. On the left, near the chair, was Betty Two-Horse, an old native woman with frizzy hair who was slowly sinking back into the earth, her spine bending between her shoulders, the folds of her ears and neck adorned with native-made jewelry. Jeremiah Wilson sat next to her. His labored breathing and oxygen hose were a palpable force in the room, filling it with the sucking regularity of his respiration. Cedra Wilkes was next to him. She was in her late 30s, and her face had a sort of elfin beauty. She smiled encouragingly at Johnny. Next to her was Jim Hole in the Sky, nearly 50, and a respected scholar who wrote Ojibwe histories and taught college in Virginia. Tribal Chair Ed Bishop sat to Eagle's left at the head of the table, wearing a sporty black racing jacket with beer logos. Bishop was a former lobbyist for the band's casino enterprise and at 45 he was energetic, entrepreneurial, and aggressive as a tribal chair, wound tight but politically smooth and good at building consensus among council members and elders who, in many other bands, were constantly at odds with one another. He had overseen the drive at the state capitol to secure matching funds to build the new community center they were sitting in. That had earned him a decade of goodwill and a reputation as a visionary, which he was determined to utilize in order to push through more changes. He opposed expanded state gambling and managed the band's touchy political tap dance on the issue of copper mining. Johnny's vision of a native-owned bank appealed to his sense of legacy.
"Okay, then," Bishop said. "Are we ready?"
Bishop looked around the room. The other council members all nodded, except Hole in the Sky.
"You know the town of Northlake's all over this," Hole in the Sky said. "I know, believe me," Bishop said. "I was just talking to Mayor Knudsen this morning."
"And?"
"I told him we support full prosecution of any individuals found to be guilty of arson."
"We just don't want them thinking that these events are in any way connected, or that we somehow condone what happened."
"Connected?" said Bishop.
"They already are," replied Wilkes. "We've had 14 cars with slashed tires and 3 more arsons of our own since. White teens are thinking it's a sport to drive through the reservation housing developments at night. I'm worried that someone else is going to get hurt."
"Look," said Eagle, "maybe we should table this. I don't want to put you in hot water. That wouldn't do any of us any good."
Getting help from the band was something he had avoided previously. He was a newcomer, and a suspect one at that. He also wasn't good at politics, and getting embroiled in a larger controversy over the arson in town was the last thing he wanted. But Bishop had paid him a visit soon after his fledgling bank burned. He brought Wilkes and Hole in the Sky with him, and the four of them had sat in Eagle's small office and discussed what he was trying to do and how he was trying to honor Winona's vision. They decided to help him. But now that they were on board, it suddenly seemed as if things were infinitely more complicated, especially after the Northlake Bank arson, which had created problems for everyone. Bishop leaned forward.
"We're elected to get stuff done," he said. "I'll call the motion. All those in favor of providing Nature's Bank with free space in the southeast corner of the community center in exchange for the prescribed equity share in the enterprise?"
Several members said,
"Aye."
"Opposed?"
Silence. The council members began to smile at Eagle.
"Motion carries."
He banged his gavel. Eagle was stunned.
"Did that really just happen?"
he said.
"It really just happened," replied Bishop.
"We've got ourselves a new tribal bank."
The councilors broke into grins and pushed back their chairs, reaching over the table to shake hands and congratulate Eagle. Even Wilson struggled to his feet and extended a frail hand. Eagle couldn't quite believe it. These people had regarded him as an interloper just a year ago, and now they were backing him despite the risk. He laughed and shook their hands, overcome with gratitude. Brushing the horse, Jacob felt satisfied. The fear and guilt and anxiety had subsided, and he could almost recall what it was like to feel normal. J.W. had taught him from the beginning that brushing was a critical part of both training and riding, and now he did it religiously and meditatively, extending his connection with pride. Dirt and sweat combined with pressure points on the saddle to make hot spots. Brushing pride after rides got some of the dirt and sweat out and stimulated his skin to prevent sores. As Jacob brushed, pride hung his head lower and lower, closing his eyes, and Jacob moved more and more slowly, losing himself in the musky smell of horse sweat and dander. J.W. walked in to help with the stall duty. He took some of the wild rice greens and fed them to pride over the stall half wall as Jacob finished brushing him. Despite Jacob's performance in the ring and his generally good mood, he was quieter than usual. No rapid-fire stream of questions. None of the usual jabs and insults.
"You doing okay?" J.W. asked as he flopped the unused saddle back onto its wood stand.
"Yeah."
"You just had a great ride out there,"
You seem kind of quiet.
No. A little bit. I'll be all right.
He couldn't tell J.W. about the fire, or the shooting, or the compass stabbing, even though he trusted him. He was too ashamed. He took Pride's feed bucket out and gave him a scoop of sweet feed.
My dad's getting an eagle feather tonight, he said, walking over to the hay stacked on pallets in the corner. I'm supposed to be in the ceremony.
He flipped open his switchblade and cut the twine strands to pop open a new bale, then slipped it back in his shirt pocket.
It's the highest honor native people give, he said, opening the bale. He's getting it because of the bank.
He carried two flakes of hay over to Pride's stall.
You want to come?
Jacob shrugged, and emotion welled up in him unexpectedly. He quickly turned away and stuffed the flakes in Pride's hay rack. J.W. nodded when Jacob glanced back at him, signaling acknowledgement but not agreement. He glanced out at the guys working in the pole barn. J.W. knew they were keeping an eye on them.
Your dad wouldn't want me there, he said. At least not until I've talked to him.
He won't be back before then, said Jacob. Ernie's driving me. Please, I just need...
But then he stopped.
It's stupid, never mind.
He began restacking the tipping hay bales.
You really want me to go?
Jacob turned and wiped his face on the back of his hand.
No, it's okay. It's bad anyway.
J.W. nodded and stood there watching him.
I'd need to take the truck, he finally said.
He nodded to where the keys hung on the nail.
Yeah, sure,
Jacob glanced back from his stacking.
But only if you want to.
Bob Grossman woke in the middle of the night with pain shooting down his left arm. His chest felt like it was being squeezed by an iron band, and he was in a cold sweat. He rolled over and woke Margie, and after trying to persuade him for a half an hour, she drove him to the hospital in Virginia. The cardiologist, it turned out, was an old classmate from high school in Cloquet named Newt Niewold.
I think it's post-traumatic stress disorder, Margie told him.
You have been listening to Episode 18 of Sins of Our Fathers by Sean Lawrence Otto. The novel will be presented in a total of 23 episodes. If you miss any, you can catch up on our website, ktwh.org. Choose Programs and then Literally from the North Shore from the drop-down list. Please join us again next time for Episode 19 of Sins of Our Fathers, here on Literally from the North Shore.